I will just give a brief advertisement before I start. My brother-in-law is Andrew Keeler, and he spent 2 years on the MCC canner. I just saw in your bulletin you had them there. And so I've kind of been close to the canning crew because they come around two times every year. And so at my parents' house, they house some of the canner guys, and they come over in the evenings and play games and stuff. So I'm kind of close to them. And they're starting. I don't know what people's schedules are like, but if the canning in Kidron conflicts with your schedule and you wanted to help, the canner is going to is actually already set up. They're going to start canning at the Harvest Call building just down the road here. They're going to begin tomorrow. They're doing 48,000 pounds this year, but they're doing an extra 10,000 because of Houston. That's going to be sent to Houston. So if anybody is inclined and wants to help, I'm sure all the help that could be taken would be much appreciated because of the extra time that's going to be spent in the canning. So if anybody's interested in that, they're running it from starting tomorrow morning through Thursday. So that's my advertisement. Okay, so we're moving right along, and this story that we're going to be talking about this morning is one of my favorites in this book. But when we think about this story, we think about the identity and the very character of Paul himself. And Paul, when we talk about him, he's one of these great heroes of the Christian church that has been long looked at and admired. He's this tireless preacher, teacher, missionary, church planter. When we think of Paul, we think of different letters. We think of different cities. We think of the cities of Philippi and Ephesus and Corinth and Athens, Thessalonica and Antioch. And finally, towards the end of his life, even Rome itself. But before any of these places, Paul had traveled to an area known as Galatia. And you see that highlighted there. This large area of Galatia is where Paul was sent a couple of times. And it's here in this region where Paul finds perhaps a companion that he didn't quite expect. And so that's the story that we have. And our text for this morning is in chapter 15, verse 36, going through the end of chapter 16. And so we have a couple stories plugged in here, and so we're going to work through them one at a time. But we start at the beginning. We start where we left off with the council last time. We had the Jerusalem council deciding what it should be, how the Gentiles should be included. What does it mean for the Gentiles to be followers of Jesus? So the council had decided on this and given a letter, and then they went off again. So after the council and back in Antioch, Paul suggested to Barnabas that they visit numerous of these places where they had preached to see how the believers there were faring. Barnabas wanted to take along John Mark. But Paul, he didn't think that was such a good idea. He had abandoned them and headed back to Jerusalem when they were up north. And so there was a sharp contention among them. Barnabas, we find in his character, is one for second chances. We see that even with Paul himself being called Saul at the time. And he was the one who introduced Paul to the other apostles and so on and so forth. So here you see Barnabas wanting to give John Mark a second chance. Paul more than likely wants to have someone who's a little bit more committed to the mission. So actually the Greek language here indicates that this contention was extremely sharp. Not that they ended or split as enemies, but it was sharp enough that they couldn't work together any longer, at least at this point. We do see them have some sort of somewhat of a reconciliation a little bit later, but they parted ways for this work. So the split that happens here kind of stands in stark contrast to what we saw in the last story with a unity that came together for the sake of the Gentiles and the diplomacy that happened and how everything was handled so well. Then here we have this story that begins and you have this split happen over this one individual. So it shows, too, how this is still a very human endeavor. God is using human agents to go about finishing his work. And so even the very best that we have to offer sometimes can end up going in ways that we hadn't perceived. So Paul takes Silas, and they went through Syria and Cilicia. So we come to, I'm calling scene one here, and I'm calling this Paul's passion, because in this chapter we see a Paul come out that we hadn't quite seen before. And in this story that we see is amazing in every way. It's just a well-written story. It communicates everything that humans love about a story. It's got drama. It's got everything. And so we have Paul come through this as this hero of the Christian faith. But before we get into that, I want you to think of Paul, not just as this apostle. I want you to think of Paul as a Jewish rabbi. And I have a reason for telling you this. Think about Jesus. Jesus went about preaching, of course, but Jesus also was on the hunt for disciples. Jesus continued to make disciples and called them to himself. He had 12, and then we find also that he had 70, right? So Jesus is preaching, and the reason one has disciples in their world is because how do you ensure that the message is going to continue to be spread? Well, you have to train those who are coming behind you to take on the work that you believe in. So Paul is doing this as well. So he's this itinerant preacher, and he's going from city to city. Now, immediately, we can ask, well, what was it? What was it that drove Paul? What was behind this? What kept him going from city to city? Well, there's numerous things. We can't say for sure what it was, but there are numerous things we can bring out. So perhaps he thought that Jesus' return was very soon. And so he wanted to reach more people. It's a possibility. Maybe the opposition that he continued to encounter at these different locations, maybe the opposition kept pushing him onward. Maybe it was just an intense passion within him to spread this new message of hope to Gentiles who were very willing to hear it. Perhaps, maybe, like the rabbi that he was, and like the one he claimed to follow, Rabbi Jesus, maybe he was looking for disciples. Maybe he was looking for those who could learn from him and continue on Jesus' mission. And he says this, actually, in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, when he says, "Be imitators of me, as I imitate Christ." And also, we find, if we look back at chapter 14, we found that he had made many disciples in this cities of Iconium and Lystra and Antioch. So that's where we're going next. So you remember these cities. I had this map up for you before. I have them highlighted there so you can kind of have the region in mind. Paul, at the beginning, goes back to these cities called Derbe and Lystra. And Paul might have been asking himself, why do I keep coming back here? I mean, it's not like there's a lot going on there. They're not these major hubs of metropolitan life or anything. They're kind of out in the middle of nowhere. So I remember telling you a few weeks ago when we were studying chapter 14 that I was going to have you recall in a couple weeks something I said. So I'm going to refresh you a little bit on that because it comes into play in our story today. So Paul was first in Derbe and Lystra when he was there. And remember what happened. I'm just throwing you a couple pictures up here so you can get a mental image as to what it looks like. It's kind of no man's land. So this is the road from Iconium to Lystra. Things were going well in Derbe and Lystra until there were some people from Antioch and Iconium who came. And remember, they came and they dragged Paul out of the city and stoned him. This is the Tell Lystra. A tell is a place that's an archaeological term that where a city that maybe was destroyed or was not inhabited, and then it was rebuilt upon, and over time, the building and rebuilding and rebuilding creates kind of this man-made hill. And so when archaeologists go and excavate a city, they go to these hills called tells, and then they can cut through them and see the different layers over time where the cities were built. So this is Tell Lystra, the city where Paul is. And so Paul's dragged out of the city, and he's presumed dead. Remember back in chapter 14. It says that the disciples came and surrounded him. Now remember, there's disciples here already. Disciples surrounded him. He got up and then went back into the city. Remember that? And then the next day, he and Barnabas went on to Derbe. So this is the first time he's there. And after proclaiming the good news, the gospel there, preaching, he made many disciples. So this becomes an important context for what I'm going to tell you next. Now here's the road from Lystra to Derbe. Doesn't look like much of a road. Looks more like a field, but that's kind of my point. What keeps bringing Paul back here? Why is he here again? Okay? So what we're going to find out is that that Paul comes to Derbe and Lystra, and there's somebody who lives here in the first three verses of chapter 16. A guy named Timothy. Timothy, the text doesn't give us much about him. More than likely, Timothy's pretty young. Says that his mother was a Jew. His father was a Greek. and he had a great reputation in the region. So Paul comes here. He's preaching. And we see this fiery, passionate Paul preaching the gospel. Very fervent. Timothy's watching this. Those people from Iconium come in Antioch. They drag Paul out of the city and they stone him. Timothy's watching this. What does Paul do? Maybe Timothy's even one of the people who comes and surrounds Paul, thinking he's dead. Paul gets up and he marches right back in the city. Man, these people are interested in what God wants to tell them. Think about the passion that's involved here. I mean, if it were me, I might be getting up and running away with my tail between my legs saying, okay, I told them, they're not interested. No, that's not what Paul does. Can you imagine how this affected Timothy? I mean, passion like this is infectious. Timothy, what became of Timothy then? So then Paul left. Timothy can be saying, well, there went my chance. Paul's gone. What you think may have been going through Timothy's mind? But then, one day, Paul comes back. Here comes Paul again. Paul, man, why am I back here? Timothy picks up on this. So I want to give you a couple points of contemplation. One is of bearing the weaker. And we talked about circumcision last week. And it seems like a kind of an odd topic for a sermon. And that's not my topic. But it comes into play because of this idea of bearing the weaker. Timothy's father is a Greek. His mother is a Jew. Timothy, we find, is not circumcised. And like I told you before, this is a big deal to Jews because it has everything to do with your identity as being part of God's covenant. Now, Paul, when he takes Timothy with him, immediately circumcises him. Well, wait a minute, Paul. You just got done saying, they just said that Gentiles shouldn't be circumcised. It seems kind of like an opposite thing. Well, what's happening here is that, and we can't say for certain again, but more than likely what's happening here is that Paul wants, in the text actually it points to it, that he doesn't want to be a stumbling block for those to whom he speaks. And so for Jews, because of this time period, it can be a little confusing because of how identity was changing. But at this time period, more than likely, the authorities and those who would be classified as Jews, they took their identity as Jews from their mother, not from their father. So because Timothy's mother was a Jew, the Jews of the region may have thought of Timothy as a Jew. And he's uncircumcised. This is an abomination to them. And so Paul wants them to be able to hear his message. On the other hand, you have Timothy's father, who is a Greek. Now, it's an abomination for Greeks to be circumcised. Talk about some tension. And so up until this point, he hadn't been. But since he's going to be with Paul, Paul doesn't want this to be a stumbling block to the ministry and the message that he wants to proclaim. So what does he do? He circumcised him. And that's where it comes into bearing the weak. To where if this is going to be an issue, it's in Paul's mind, at least in this text, it wasn't an issue. We saw that in Antioch. That's not something that Gentiles need to do. It has nothing to do with your identity in Christ. But yet, because some might struggle with it, we don't want to be a stumbling block to them. Just have it happen. That way, they can hear the message without us being in front of it and creating difficulty. So that's one of the considerations I want to give you. Another one is this idea of being worthy of emulation. Paul provided this role model and embodied this passionate pursuit of Jesus. So think about today's culture and the role models that take the center stage for anything from athletes to Hollywood stars or whatever. Think about the message that is being communicated. And think about even in a more immediate context. Think about in your world, those who may be looking to you as a role model. What kind of model are we setting for the younger generation? What does the younger generation see in us? Do they see a passionate pursuit or do they see apathy? What is it that we communicate to them about this life and this journey of faith in seeking after God as being followers of Jesus? Do they see intensity or do they see apathy? Are we more like Paul or are we more like, well, I'm not going to give you a bad example. But anyways, what are we teaching the next generation? What do they see in those who are going before them? What kind of legacy are we leaving behind? Where is the passion that we see in Paul? Where do we find that? And does it exist? Can it exist? And does it have anything to do with us immediately in our pursuit of being like our rabbi, Jesus? So back to the story. They go from town to town, and it says that they're delivering this message that was decided on at Jerusalem. So they're delivering this message to the believers around. And so they strengthen these believers, and it says that the numbers grew daily. So then they go through this area of Phrygia and Galatia. They made their way to the region of Mysa, and then on to Troas. You see that at the top left there. Here, Paul has a night vision where a man from Macedonia was pleading for help. And so Macedonia is this region over here. And so Paul takes this as divine direction, and they head to Macedonia, particularly to the city known as Philippi, which is one of the leading cities of Macedonia. So that brings us to the next section of our story, and I'm calling that one Midnight Melodies. Now, the city of Philippi is a very important city in the area of Macedonia. It takes its name from Philip II. And if that doesn't ring a bell with you, Philip II was Alexander the Great's father. And so I'm sure all of you have heard of Alexander the Great. It takes its name from him because in 256 BC, Philip came to the city, enlarged the walls, reinforced the walls, and established it as a military base there. And actually, Philippi was one of the cities that formed Rome to what it became. There was a major battle that happened here between the imperialists and the republicans when Rome was having all this difficulty. And so the battle with Brutus and Cassius happened there. And it comes into the story because Brutus and Cassius end up committing suicide after the battle, even though they had the upper hand of the battle, when Octavian took on a name later called Caesar Augustus, and you all are familiar with Caesar Augustus. Caesar Augustus, called then Octavian, was trying to right his uncle's death. His adopted father, who was Julius Caesar, was killed by Brutus and Cassius. So he and Mark Antony pursued them to Philippi. They were camped there. The battle happened. By all means, Brutus and Cassius should have won because they had a bigger military, but they didn't. They lost. And so Philippi became this major center of military might. It was a Roman colony. So that was a very important aspect to it. But Paul and Silas, and Paul and company actually, are here on the Sabbath, and they sought a place to meet for prayer. And so there was apparently no synagogue there. And actually, to have a synagogue properly, you had to have at least 10 Jewish males. And so they didn't have that. So they couldn't find that. So what they did was they looked for someone who was having a prayer meeting in our type of vocabulary. They're looking for a prayer meeting. And so they go outside the city and they go down by the river and they find some women there who are having their God fears. And so they're speaking with the women there. And I love this picture because here they're not in a synagogue or anything because nothing exists there. And so they're down by the river, and it doesn't say that they were preaching to the women. It says that they were sitting there and they're having conversation. They're just sitting by the river, out in nature more than likely, and they're having conversation with these women. And among them is a woman named Lydia. And she was a God-fearer. And because of the conversation that she's having, because of speaking with Paul, she wants to become a believer in this message that Paul's proclaiming. And so she's baptized. And then it goes on that she then becomes one who provides hospitality for Paul. And so then another day comes along. And again, Paul is going to pray. Then there's a slave girl that's following them along. And a slave girl that we're told that has a spirit of divination. And because of this spirit of divining, she brought her owners a lot of money through this art of fortune telling. So she's following Paul and his company for a while and keeps proclaiming, "These men are slaves of the Most High God and proclaim to you a way of salvation." That doesn't sound at all bad. So many days she's doing this. Finally, Paul gets annoyed and says, turns around and orders this spirit out of her. Now, if you think about it, she's not really saying anything that's wrong, is she? She's telling the truth. They were men of the Most High God, and they were proclaiming a message of salvation. But actually, it's wanting you to think about someone else too. Think about Jesus. Think about who testified of Jesus. The demons, remember? Servant of the Most High God, Son of God. And Jesus didn't say, "Right on, brother." No, he said, "Be quiet." And he wouldn't let them speak. Sometimes he drove them out. Well, is it because they were saying something that was wrong? No. But you don't want that side proclaiming you. And so you have this disconnect between the side that's clearly the enemy, the evil forces, being silenced. So the owners become enraged at this because all of a sudden their profitable business has just gone out the window. And so they seized Paul and Silas, and they took them to the authorities, to the magistrates. So they were charged with disturbing the city as Jews who are advocating practices that are not worthy of Romans. This is an important detail because they're in Philippi. And Philippi is a Roman colony. And what that means is that a Roman colony is a miniature Rome, meaning that everything that happens in Rome also happens here. That means all of the laws of Rome apply here. If you are a citizen of Rome, then you are treated in a Roman colony the same way as you're treated in Rome. You have all of the same liberties. You have all the same rights. You're treated with utmost respect. So don't think that far and wide that Roman citizens were just super common. That's not. Roman citizenry, and we find that in the mouth of one of the the officials later in Acts about how hard it was to obtain citizenry of Rome, to be a Roman citizen. So Paul and Silas are Roman citizens, but that doesn't come out yet. So they're seized by these authorities, and they're attacked, they're flogged, they're beaten, they're thrown in prison, and they're ordered to be kept secure, and they're kept in the innermost cell. And they're chained with their feet in stocks. Now, this is the third dramatic jail scene that we've encountered in our journey through the book of Acts. Up till now, remember back with me with our other stories of jail scenes. What do you now, as a reader, as one who's looking at the story, what do you expect when you come to a jail scene? You're expecting that this isn't going to last, right? What do you think Paul expects when he gets here? He doesn't necessarily know that he's going to be released. He might be thinking, "Well, things were going so great. People are listening. Now I'm in jail." And unrightfully so. Paul, in his tradition, as a Jewish rabbi, as this intense studier of the text, even before his life changed, even before he's following Jesus, back even when he's persecuting, you have to understand that Paul is a man of the Scriptures. He, if I compare him to the contemporary rabbis of his status of his day, he would have been what was called a master of Tanakh. Now, Tanakh is another word for the Jewish Bible, which is what we call the Old Testament. And a master of Tanakh means that he would have the entire thing memorized. Not just the names of the books, the entire Bible, basically. There's still people who have this, who do this today. It's unbelievable. But they can recite pretty much any part of it at any point. And I want you to think about something with me because it comes into our story. So Paul has been shown to be quite competent and able to argue persuasively from the text. And so they're in jail, and it says that about midnight, Paul and Silas began singing and praying in singing hymns to God. And the prisoners were listening to them. They had the prisoners' attention. So this scene of singing at midnight, what should we make of this? Is he thinking maybe a rescue like Peter's, that he's calling out to God? It doesn't say that. But I want you to think about this. What if Paul is thinking about his Bible? Maybe he's thinking about the story of Samson in Judges chapter 16. It says, where Samson lay until midnight. Then at midnight, Samson arose and took hold of the doors of the city gate and the two posts, and he pulled them up, bar and all. He put them on his shoulders, and he carried them to the top of the hill. Maybe he's thinking about Samson, that maybe God's going to send his angel, and he's going to rip the place apart, and he's going to waltz out there with Paul. Or maybe he's thinking about the story of Boaz and Ruth, where at midnight, Boaz's life is changed forever. It says that at midnight, Boaz was startled, and that's in Ruth chapter 3. Or maybe Paul's thinking about the book of Job, where the words of Elihu is praising God and going on praising God, says that God shows no partiality to nobles, nor regards the rich more than the poor, for they are all the work of his hands. At midnight, the people are shaken and pass away, and the mighty are taken away by no human hand. And he heard the cry of the afflicted. Maybe Paul's thinking about Job. Or maybe Paul is singing from his hymn book. Paul's hymn book is the Psalms. I want to read you a psalm. And I'm not saying one thing definitively or the other. I'm just putting these out before you. And you can wrestle with them. But listen to this psalm, Paul's hymns. Blessed are you, O Lord, teach me your statutes. I live as an alien in the land. Even though princes sit plotting against me, your servant will meditate on your statutes. Your decrees are my delight. They are my counselors. My soul clings to the dust. Revive me according to your word. I have chosen the way of faithfulness. I set your ordinances before me. This is my comfort in my distress, that your promise gives me life. The arrogant utterly deride me, but I do not turn away from your law. When I think of your ordinances from old, I take comfort, O Lord. Your statutes have been my songs wherever I make my home. I remember your name in the night, O Lord, and I keep your law. Though the cords of the wicked ensnare me, I do not forget your law. At midnight, I rise to praise you because of your righteous ordinances. My zeal consumes me because my foes forget your words. I rise before dawn and cry for help. I put my hope in your words. I cry to you, save me, that I may observe your decrees. My eyes are awake before each watch of the night, that I may meditate on your promise. Those who persecute me with evil purpose draw near. They are far from your law. Let my supplication come before you. Deliver me according to your promise. My lips will pour forth praise because you teach me your statutes. My tongue will sing of your promise, for all of your commandments are right. If Paul is singing from his hymn book, and this is the hymn that he has chosen to sing, he's crying out to God for help. And he's doing it with praise on his lips. And the prisoners are watching. They don't necessarily know Paul's hymn book. It'd be the same thing as if I went to a prison in a different country and started singing it as well. They're not necessarily going to know my hymn, right? Paul is praising God in front of these, and they see the conditions that they're in. What do you think those people are thinking? What is our response when hardship comes? What kind of trust do we have in the God we serve? Are we ready to sing even when we may not understand what is happening to us? The things that are happening before us? Circumstances that are outside of our control? What do our actions communicate to those who are watching? And I'm riding on the tails of what I said before about having that passionate pursuit and being role models to the younger generation and showing them what passionate living for Jesus means. What does this say about our passion for our God? All of a sudden, there's an earthquake. The doors were opened. Their chains were loosened. The jailer woke up and saw the results and was about to kill himself, assuming that all the prisoners had escaped. Now again, if you're in Philippi and you're a reader of this story and you know the story of Philippi, you're thinking about Brutus and Cassius, who also killed themselves because they saw there was no hope. This jailer, he thinks he's been defeated. Whether he was knocked unconscious by an earthquake, whatever it was, it doesn't say. Either way, he woke up and he realized, I'm in trouble. Paul calls out to him, don't harm yourself. We're all present. The jailer then pleads with Paul and Silas to tell him what he must do to be saved. Paul responds that he must trust in the Lord Jesus, which by Paul even saying that, this is a Roman colony. To call anybody but Caesar Lord is blasphemy. To say that Jesus is Lord is to say that Caesar is not. What does this mean for a Roman jailer? And then that even his household would be included. So Paul and company spoke to this jailer and to his household. They end up taking care of Paul and Silas, washing his wounds. And as a result, the entire family is baptized. The next morning, the authorities commanded that Paul and Silas were to be released in peace. And Paul would have none of it. What? Did I read that right? We've been shamed, Paul says. We've been publicly beat. We're uncharged, uncondemned Romans, both Silas and I. We've been wrongfully imprisoned. This comes to a little bit of a backstory in Philippi, which I'm not going to go into because it's a major piece. But in Philippi, one of the most driving factors of life in Philippi is a competition and a desire to bring honor to oneself. And this actually comes into the story in Paul's letter when he writes to the Philippians, when he speaks about honor. It was the desire of every person that you bring in your lifetime as much honor to yourself as possible, and that you can die with a very glorified name. So anything that decreases that or that goes against that desire to have a good, honorable name is bad. And so here, at the end of this stay in the jail, Paul brings out and brings public shame to these magistrates, because they could be in big trouble for having done this to Roman citizens. Because Paul and Silas both have rights, and this was wrong, according to Roman standards, Roman law. So the police go back to the authorities, because if Paul said, you're not going to just cast us out in secret. This isn't going to happen. And so the magistrates become very afraid because of this. And so you see Paul being shamed and then turning around, and shame is brought to the magistrates who did them wrong. So it's this exchange of an act of shame and kind of, in some ways, exonerates Paul and Silas, at least in Roman standards. So there were apologies that were made. I'm sure there was some groveling involved. And then they were asked to leave the city. They stopped by Lydia's house, encouraging everyone there before they departed.